This is the Killer Innovations Podcast with Phil McKinney. Keep in mind that the information and opinions expressed in this podcast are Phil's and Phil's alone, and they don't necessarily reflect those of his past, current, or future employers. Now, here's Phil McKinney.
So what is the number one risk to you taking your idea and making it into a success? If you're the innovator inside of a large organization, the number one roadblock that you're going to run into is what I refer to as the corporate antibodies. These are individuals who basically put up the roadblocks, the questions, the challenges, and those that give you the outright no answer to move forward with the idea. Now, the way to identify them is typically in the response when you're pitching them the idea that you want to move forward with. They come back with answers like, oh, let's shelve that for the time being. You know, who's going to do it? We don't have the resources. I have something better. We should be doing my idea instead. Oh, we tried that before. Don't rock the boat. The market's not ready. You'll never get approval. These are all kind of off-the-cuff responses from these corporate antibodies, these people who view themselves as really being the protector of the organization. Now, it's easy for those of us in the innovation game to blame the corporate antibodies as just being bad people or people who don't get it. But to win them over, and you have to either win them over or you have to figure out a way to go around them in order for your idea to be a success. The key in assimilating them or getting them onto your side is kind of understanding the psychology behind why they are the way they are. And what I have found is they fall into a number of different categories. One of the more common categories that I've run into in the form of the corporate antibodies is what I call the ego response. These are people who view the idea as some kind of a challenge to their role, to their position. In some cases, they may think of themselves as being the idea person. And how dare you come forward and present an idea that didn't come from them? Some of the word usage that you'll hear in pushback to help you identify those people who are coming after your idea based on an ego response are things like, oh, I already thought of that a long time ago. Somebody else has already come up with that idea, or I have something better. It's basically an immediate response to your idea. They feel threatened. Now, what do you do in this case? For those that you have challenged and they feel threatened, one way that I have found to be very effective in winning them over to your idea is to simply go to them early with an idea, present it in a very raw, unstructured format, and ask for their input. Now, you'll immediately get the corporate antibody response, but keep digging, keep asking questions. Ask them for their input. What would they change to make this idea better? Now, it doesn't matter what they propose. Put it down. Put it in the presentation. Give them credit. Next time you're out there presenting it to other senior executives, you can say, hey, I presented this and Joe thought of this really great idea to enhance it. We've added this in. And by simply assimilating their idea, you've diminished the ego gap problem because now you've taken their input and some of their ideas and combined it with what you are doing. Now, that's an important first step to bringing those antibodies in and turning them from being an antibody to actually becoming an advocate. Now, the second most common groups of responses that I've seen in the corporate antibody space are what I call the fatigued response. These are people who've kind of been in the game or been in the organization for so long, they've seen everything happen before, and they've just kind of thrown up their hands and they've given up. Some of the responses or the pushbacks that you'll hear from the corporate antibodies that are suffering from this fatigue are things like, you'll never get approval, we've tried that before, who's going to do it? We don't have the resources, it won't fit in our operation, you don't understand how the business works. These are all people who've been within the organization for years and in some cases decades, and they're kind of stuck in the rut. They're stuck in this perspective that we've tried change before, it's never worked before, why should it work now? Don't rock the boat, let's just continue to go forward the way we're going forward. Now, these can be somewhat a little bit more challenging because you're fighting against history of an organization, the historical memory of things that have worked and things that have not worked in the past. Now, what you can do in this case is meet with those people who've been around for a long time and ask them, what What about that last change? The thing that happened before that didn't work out, why didn't it work out? And what would they recommend for you to do in your program to avoid the same failures that the previous programs have had? Now, in many cases, when people think back, they get a little bit of a different perspective of why past projects were not successful. You know, they weren't successful because the person in charge. They weren't successful because they didn't embrace the entire organization. They weren't successful because they didn't have executive sponsorship. There's lots of reasons why things were not successful in the past. What you have to do is figure it out. Figure out what from the history, what has caused this fatigue of people trying in the past and not being successful, and really dig in and understand why, what was it that prevented these things, and then come up with an approach that addresses all of those concerns. The fatigue people are saying, you know, they're just not ready to go to battle one more time. They're not willing to be your sponsor. They're not being supportive of your idea purely because they've been around this track one too many times. Your job is to convince them why your idea is different from what has happened in the past. And the only way to do that is you got to collect the history. You've got to understand what worked and what didn't work in the past. The fatigue response tends to be the one that is the hardest to get around, because it's this fatigue or this history is literally ingrained in the culture. It's ingrained in the way people are thinking. And therefore, when new things come along, people are just like throwing up their hands saying, it's the new person. They don't really understand. They weren't here 5 years ago when we tried something like that and, you know, it got killed or wasn't successful. So with the case of these fatigues, you got to understand that history and plan for a long cycle. When you're dealing with fatigue that's inherent in an organization, the approval cycle to get your idea even just slightly moving forward is typically orders of magnitude against any other of the corporate antibodies, just because you tend to have to fight the entire organization, not just one person. The third type of corporate antibody that I come across quite commonly is the no-risk response. These are people who have taken it upon their, you know, upon themselves to literally be the antibody cops. They're to protect the organization from any kind of risk, right? They've seen previous ideas that came in where the organization took a huge risk and it blew up, wasn't successful, was a total failure, and it literally risked the organization. These are the people who now have stepped in, and their job is to take out any risk from being injected into the organization. And your idea, your innovation, is risk. Whether or not you recognize that it's risk to the organization, these people see it as risk. Now, some of the responses that you see when you're presenting these ideas that people identify as risk, or people who have this, I'm going to protect the organization role, are things like, oh, there's not enough return on investment, or we can't afford to do that. Typically, these are people who are trying to make the risk ratio trade-off of, do I put my money behind your idea, or do I put my money into some form of a safer bet, a more of a sure thing? And they're willing to trade off growth, you know, impact, higher margins for taking out that risk. In this case, in many cases, these people who have this, you know, no risk response, they are in the role of no as being that no risk, you know, low risk answer. Yes is risky. Giving you a yes answer automatically injects risk into the process. By simply saying no to everything, they take out the risk. And in their minds also, it's about career security. Nobody ever has gotten fired for saying no, right? You present an innovation, they say no. 3 years later, a competitor comes up with something new. Nobody ever remembers the person that said no. The flip side is you put out your innovation and the person says yes, and then the whole thing blows up. Everybody immediately remembers who was the person who said yes. So these are people who are just anti-risk down to their literally core being. Their whole thought processes, the way they think about their jobs is to have literally that kind of a zero risk built into the overall program that they think about. These are tough people to get around. The one way to get around the no risk is to find a corporate sponsor that is either a peer or a superior to the person that has a no risk profile. In this case, you know, maybe it's the CFO who has the no risk profile. His job is to make sure they have predictable income, revenue, and profits that they're reporting to Wall Street. Go to the CEO and get the CEO to take on the risk that's associated with the innovation programs. You know, innovation by nature is risky, you know, and a lot of organizations talk about, oh, innovation's important, but they let this risk profile dictate their decision-making process and derail any possible impact that innovation is going to have. So you've got to find a corporate sponsor who can get either a peer or above this person who is willing to take the risk profile and willing to say, yes, I'll take that risk. I'll give them the yes answer and recognize that there's some potential downside. Now, if you find that corporate sponsor, your job is to make sure that you protect your corporate sponsor. You're to put plans in place. You're to make sure you're tracking and measuring to make sure you're going to achieve success. If at any time you're potentially running into a challenge in your program where it might potentially fail, your job is to go to that sponsor and be transparent to them because they're taking the risk on your idea. You owe it to that sponsor to be transparent with them at all times and let them know where you're at in the overall program. It's a partnership between you and your idea and your corporate sponsor. And if you violate that partnership, you not only will not have success in this program, but the odds of you getting a sponsorship for any future programs immediately goes to zero. The fourth type of corporate antibody that I've come across is those that are kind of in the comfort response. These are the people who kind of like don't like change. They like things the way they are. Now, the kind of responses that you hear from people that are in this kind of comfort zone are things like, oh, we've always done it this way. Our customers like buying our products this way. Why would they want to buy a different way? Don't rock the boat. These are people who are anti-change. They want to keep things the status quo. Any change means work, and it means potentially uncertainty in their job or in the processes that are in place. These are typically inside of organizations that have been around for a while, and therefore, they just have got their processes pretty much locked down. They know exactly what the process is for step one, step two, step three, step four, and as a response, they know what is going to happen next. Everything is very predictable, and therefore, they like that. The problem is the world is changing. We are shifting from an information knowledge economy to an innovation creative economy. It's all about generating ideas. It's about taking ideas and turning them into game-changing innovations. By nature, that is change. New innovations require new processes and new products and new ways to go to market, new supply chains and new customer segment identification. All of the things around delivering an innovation is about change to the organization. And so therefore, any idea or any innovation is a direct risk to the people who have this comfort response. These people don't like any kind of change. They want to know that I come to work at 8, I get my lunch hour, I work till 5 o'clock, I don't work weekends, the risk to my job is minimal. You know, as long as I sit here and turn the crank, I'm good and I'm safe. But that's not innovation. That's not an organization or a set of people who are embrace innovation because by nature, change is necessary. So how do you get around these people? This is probably one of the tougher ones to try to navigate to get around because they're just resistant to change. One way to do it is to present them to the fact that by not changing is where the high risk is. Staying the status quo, not looking to new areas, not looking to new products, new innovations, new processes, new ways of manufacturing, new way of distributing your products, new way of finding customers. If by nature they don't go after those new ways, That is the high risk response. It's actually lower risk to embrace innovation than it is to stay the current course and speed. And you can do this by pointing to other industries, either competitors who've had trouble because they haven't embraced innovation, or by other industries that have been totally blindsided by innovation, entire companies being wiped out because they weren't willing to embrace the change. The important thing here is to counteract this view that any kind of change is risk, versus staying the status quo is where the high risk is at. Now, going through all of these different types of the corporate antibodies, so again, the ego response, the fatigue response, the no risk response, and the comfort response, those are just kind of the four major buckets of the types of corporate antibodies that you're going to run into within your organization. Now, you're not always going to be successful at getting around these corporate antibodies. In some cases, they are just so virulent, or they're in such critical roles that you just can't get around them. You've either got to convert them, or you got to get bold and come up with a completely different way in order to get your innovation to go forward. Now, there's a couple different ways to do this. One is you can go stealth. You can go deep. You can do it behind the scenes. You can do it below the radar. You can move your idea and innovation forward without really getting, quote, approval. Now, there's lots of examples of, you know, executives or people who have taken that risk and it's turned out to be a great or huge success. One area that I thought, you know, one example that I like to use is one from Chuck House, a friend of mine and a longtime HP employee who worked directly with Bill Hewlett and David Packard. Chuck came up with an oscilloscope. David and Bill did not really believe that the product was going to be successful and told Chuck that the next time both of them came around to do their lab review, they didn't want to see that oscilloscope in the lab the next time. And Chuck said, "Yes, sir." Bill and Dave leave. They go back to California. What does Chuck do? Chuck actually ships the product. They didn't really say they didn't want to. They wanted the product totally killed. What Bill and Dave said was they didn't want to see the product in the lab the next year when they came around for the review. Well, next year when Bill and Dave came around, it wasn't in the lab. The product was shipping, and the product was a phenomenal success. What did Bill and Dave do? Now, a lot of executives would just absolutely blow their cork and go crazy and, you know, you went around me, you know, you disobeyed an order. And at first, that's what happened. David said, you know, got on to Chuck and said, "Hey, I told you I didn't want to see this product anymore." And Chuck said, no, Mr. Packard, you didn't say you didn't want to, we couldn't ship it. You said you didn't want to see it in the lab. Here, let me show you the numbers. The product is a phenomenal success. And so what did Dave do? Dave went back and created an award, gave it to Chuck. It's called the Medal of Defiance. The Medal of Defiance reads, "To Chuck House, going above and beyond the duty of an engineer by ignoring management and doing the right thing." In some cases, you need to be willing to put your career at risk if you truly believe that your innovation is going to change your company, your industry, and take that risk. Now, the rest of the story behind Chuck's oscilloscope is that scope and tube and that design actually had some unique characteristics. And one of the modifications that Chuck made to that product turned it into what was called the Moon Monitor. When Apollo 11 was landing on the moon, the original plan was not to shoot to display video, but to simply make audio available, and we would see the video once the crew came back to the U.S. Chuck House's monitor, resulting from this oscilloscope, allowed NASA to actually beam the image back to the U.S. and display it. There were four moon monitors built by Chuck that NASA used. So each and every one of us who saw Neil Armstrong step on the moon is a result of Chuck House's moon monitor, which was actually the result of Chuck believing wholeheartedly in his idea and his innovation, and ignoring the stupidity of management, and moving forward with his idea and innovation, not with totally ignoring management or, you know, totally defying an order, but figuring it out a very creative way to move his idea and innovation forward, the result was not only a phenomenal product, but allowed us all around the world to watch Neil Armstrong step on the moon. So how do you learn to do this? Well, what I just shared with you is just part of the book Beyond the Obvious, Killer Questions That Spark Game-Changing Innovation. The book is now out. It is based on the six-year history of this podcast. And what I've shared with you is just some of the content from the book, specifically the entire chapter three, around the corporate antibodies. Now, I dedicated an entire chapter of the book to this challenge of corporate antibodies because it's one that is the biggest roadblock to success for your ideas and innovations. Now, the book covers pretty much the entire six-year history of the podcast, the blog, and the entire stack of the killer questions that have been rewritten specifically for the book. The book is available on Barnes & Noble, on Amazon, on Audible, if you believe in the audiobooks, but I'll warn you, it is not my voice reading the book on Audible, and it's also available in bookstores. You can go out and buy it today. So if you found this information useful, you can go back and listen to the six-year history. It's 138 or 140 shows now in the podcast. Or you can go out, pick up the book, read the book, and hopefully that will provide you with the skill sets and the information to be successful as you try to drive innovations within your organization. If you have questions, comments, feedback on this podcast or about the blog or about the book, please email them to feedback@philmckinney.com. The blog is over at philmckinney.com. You can follow me on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, Tumblr, you name the social networks. My handle on all of the social networks is Phil McKinney, all one word. Thank you for listening. Thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to listen to the podcast. Hopefully you found this information useful, and we'll talk to you real soon. Bye-bye.